Do open public input, and we do have a few folks. I think all of you know the rules here, so I'll call you up two at a time. Ken Miller and Clifford Kellogg, please. Ken, good to see you again.
I promised I wouldn't come back.
Good morning, Chair, Chairman Smith, and members of the Commission. I'm Ken Miller, small forest landowner here in the Olympia area. You should have some photos. Have those been passed around? I just want to speak briefly about those. First photo is a picture of my wife standing next to a tree that her and I and our son planted about 15 years prior to this photo being taken. Some of this is old hat for some of you that are been around a while, because I've been coming here for a number of years, but for the others, just to show you an impression of what we're facing when with bear damage. The second photo is a picture of a tree that actually survived the bear damage. It was damaged in 2000, or it damaged at about age 13. There was a little piece of bark on one side that didn't get stripped off, so the tree continued to live. And it was finally culled out about another 15 years later because it had rot all the way up the top. But the point of that is, even though the tree survived, it was worthless. 80% of the value in a tree is in the first log. So decades of investment were lost from the planting costs, the browse protectors, pruning, conifer release. And the final picture is just a graph of the bear harvest history over the years. It used to be in the 6,000 or 7,000. The last few decades, it's been about 2,000 per year. Of that 2,000, about 10% is bears harvested because of the bear damage, the bear depredation program. And the point I want to make, even though the red line, you can barely see the red line, which is the bear depredation program portion of the harvest, only about 10% of that 10% is small forest landowners. We typically have maybe a dozen or a couple dozen of us, and we might in total harvest 10 to 15 bears a year. I'm not here today to throw rocks at the department, merely give you an update on a very complex issue with a small forest landowner twist. The bad news is, after about 15 years of coming here and meeting, and many, many, many meetings with WDFW to share our dilemma, not much has really changed in the flawed depredation program that's rightly intended to protect us or help us protect our trees from unreasonable levels of ongoing damage. We do understand the department is between a rock and a hard spot. We've seen the letters, the legal letters. I'll get through this very quickly. Sadly, my effort to shed light on this issue, including speaking to the press last summer, has led to greater misunderstanding and a significant detrimental pullback by the department. I apologize to all for my involvement in all of that. Speaking truth sometimes doesn't pay off. But anyway, the good news is we will have an opportunity to meet in a collaborative program with our depredation program detractors coming up this year, as I understand it, similar to what's happened on the Wolf program. I'm looking forward to that. I'm hopeful it will lead to a more sustainable bear depredation program. The bad news is this process is going to likely require significant additional volunteer hours beyond the thousands of hours that small forest landowners have already contributed to this process. The very few small forest landowners with verified and ongoing damage will not have practical mitigation options for the upcoming damage period. The just announced rules for 2018 only have a disproportionate impact on small forest landowners who are now rightly in panic mode. Summary, small forest landowners really need help over the next 3 months. Without real help, how can we be expected to participate in good faith in yet another new process? I thank you for your understanding. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Director, your thoughts?
Well, I want to first just recognize the thousands of hours that Ken and some of his fellow small landowners have put into this issue. We have worked together pretty well. We haven't achieved everything that folks had hoped in terms of protecting those investments. We've got, you know, it's another one of these wildlife conflict situations where we're trying to balance various values and a number of issues, and we're dedicated to keep trying, Ken. Don't want to make it process, and no substance at the end of the day, but we got to figure out a way to get the right people around the table and strike that balance. So
we met last Friday, a few of us, with a couple of WDFW folks, and tossed out some brainstorming ideas, just band-aids that might help us get through the process, and I hope that some of those will actually come to fruition. You know, the main thing from a small landowner perspective and is just having somebody out on the ground, you know, just kind of go pee along a tree or something, just keep the scent out there so the bears will kind of stay away, something like that. And you're going to approve later today some spring bear hunt deal, which is, you know, for industry and big parcels. A band-aid might be just giving us, each of us that have ongoing verified damage, a couple of tags, and we'll work with a master hunter or somebody that will actually go out and just kind of be around, and if they find fresh damage, then we can get into the program. But you know, and there's some other ideas. The department apparently has some of these big culvert traps that they might be able to bring a few of those out to just small forest landowners. But we're in panic when you've got this kind of damage and it's ongoing and you know it's going to be there. All the tools that are out there, even in a perfect world, are not perfect. It's just an ongoing problem, but we need help. We have half of the private forest land in Washington State. We're talking about 1% of the annual harvest. We're dropping the bucket from that standpoint. But
well, thanks for your leadership, continued leadership, and I think, given what Director Storr said, I mean, we'll be working with you. So, and
okay, we look forward to forward to hearing.
So, Mr. Miller, I'm a bit new to this process, so I haven't had the chance to meet you personally, but thank you. You're also in my county, so
okay.
I should meet you. So this will be an elementary question. Given the sort of emotion over this, over the issue that you raise, I don't believe it's the hunt itself or even the numbers of bears that are hunted that's the that people have taken exception to, but it is the methods, some of the methods, especially the hound hunting part of it. How important is having that tool to you as you figure out how to control the animals that are damaging your property?
Okay. There are no good answers. Hound hunting is the most effective and the most targeted way to deal with the problem bears. You know, we see law enforcement, the military using dogs, the department uses hounds. You know, they're just the best. But there's lots of issues around that, and there's a long history that has contributed to the negative publicity around that. small landowners can't all use hound hunters. I have. I'm in a location down in Grays Harbor County where my damage area is, and it's been somewhat effective, but I have such a small area, I can't hardly get anybody to come in, and it's a 10-minute hunt for them, you know, so they're going someplace else. During the 18 years or so that I've been coming here, the department did create something called a Master Hunter Program, or at least maybe it's been around for a number of years, but it became available for us. And so more and more small landowners are using the Master Hunter Program, where once you've got shown damage, hunter can come in, use bait, and hunt over bait. There's been some problems around that, but that looks like the, you know, a good improving tool. That was essentially taken away from us this year because of good reasons. I understand there's the issue about keeping the bear. The master hunter does, that's kind of their reward for all the volunteer hours that they provide. They get to keep the bear. Well, for this upcoming season, they can't keep the bear. So that effectively eliminates that option. It really is the only option for smalls. But I think the hound hunters have cleaned up their act quite a bit. A lot of the issues are just remnants from past. But
Understand you then hear the urgency. I understand also that the process that we've entered into is similar to this Wolf Advisory Committee group that now a group has been set up to look at bear damage and how it's going to be managed. Has that group met? Is it because, as you point out, this is a process and it takes a while. Right. I mean, we've been at it with the WAG for years.
Yeah. I have met with Donnie Martorella. He's been going around interviewing folks. I've known Donnie for a number of years. I have a lot of confidence in him. Commissioner Holtzmiller called me and berated me a little bit. Now, there's this new process. You got to participate. There's been really good stuff that's happened in the wolf issue, and I've always been kind of a believer in the collaborative process. I'm involved in that in Forest and Fish big time. I was already convinced, but you know, he made a very strong case, as did Donnie when we met with him. But that isn't going to start until May or something, and so that's why we've been pleading with the department. Let's find some little band-aid that at least helps at least the small landowners. I have no idea what industry is doing. I know they're, you know, up in the air about what's going on, but we just would appreciate a special band-aid just for this season, because I am very hopeful of that process going. We have a hell of a good story to tell, and that initiative that was passed a number of years ago, and I admit I didn't know a damn thing about it. I voted for that damn thing because I had been in Georgia and tried to go deer hunting, and there was no hunting, no public land you could hunt on, and they hunt deer with dogs down there. And that's not fair, you know. So when this initiative popped up, I did the knee-jerk reaction, just like a majority of the citizens did, and said, well, that doesn't sound fair. But it's like a lot of natural resource issues. If you don't really understand what's going on, the things that you guys deal with all the time, it's a lot more complicated than what it sounds on the surface. And some of the options that are currently available are less humane than hound hunting. So,
thanks again.
Thank you very much for your time.
Quickly, Brad.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Ken and I spent time on the phone together talking about these issues, and I do want to thank Eric and Denise and Mick for taking time out of their schedule to meet with Ken here a week or so ago and help him. I am jealous, though. You're showing this picture of the tree, and it's been damaged, so you know it hasn't grown very good, but my gosh, the growth rings are still, I wish I could get growth rings on my trees like that. But I do just have a, what's that?
Warm water.
Yeah.
Or you could sing to them, too.
No, I think it's the water thing in the soil. which we lack a lot of. But no, it, and there again, hopefully you can have some patience, and hopefully we can work out if you have some issues this year. I know you put between a rock and a hard spot. And one thing that Ken keeps bringing up to me, and it's very important, because if you're a warehouser with umpteen million acres of ground and you lose a couple acres here and there, that's one thing. But when these guys start losing an acre here and an acre there, it adds up and it's a big hit to them. So I know we have to treat everybody kind of the same, but the volume, the scale thing is huge for these small landowners. So
the area that I have damage and have had damage on for a number of years is 42 acres is all, and I've got 60% of the trees have been damaged or killed. And that's catastrophic, especially when you've got your own sweat equity. And into, you know, in 1990 we planted these trees, and we still have another 15 years to go before we even have a chance to get a return. The loss is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars just on that 42 acres. So,
thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
And tell your grandson hi and good luck in college. Rob Kreibel and Clifford.
Okay, I did
the Falcons.
I apologize. I didn't know if I was supposed to come up and sit next to Ken. So, Ken, I apologize.
No, that's the
wrong thing.
He's got a better haircut than I got.
There you go. That's right. So, Chairman Smith, commissioners, department agency personnel, my name's Cliff Kellogg, currently the North Pacific Director for the North American Falconers Association. I am the historian for the Washington Falconers Association, and I founded that organization back in 1980. I thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'll keep my comments very brief. I want to comment on item number 9, migratory waterfowl seasons. I see there is a slight increased opportunity for falconers there, and I thank you for that. Any increased opportunity is appreciated. And then I'd like to jump to item 20, which talks about hunter orange requirements. And I see there that the hunter orange exemption that falconers had is retained. So I appreciate that. And the important part about that is I have a 23-year-old Harris hawk. She still doesn't like that bright color up close after all those years. Sometimes you just can't get them to do it. So it still continues to make sense. That's all the comments I have. If you had any questions about falconry or birds of prey, I'm here for you.
Yeah, a few years ago, I had the pleasure to go out with up in Whatcom County, and I forget the name of the guy I went with, but he's right up by the Canadian border.
Danny Pike.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it was a great experience. I'd never done that before. I encourage, if any of you, I mean, get an opportunity to, you've invited commissioners before. I know it's,
oh yeah. The other thing I would offer is, and logistically that's tough, but if you all would be interested in a presentation on falconry, I give them to Girl Scout troops, I give them to Boy Scout troops, churches, everything, and we talk a lot about falconry as a hunting sport, as conservation, the whole gambit. So if you're ever interested in that, I'm your guy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And Martha. So Rob.
Good morning, commissioners. Rob Kreibel, Northwest Representative with Defenders of Wildlife, and here this morning providing some testimony in support of the bear identification test that y'all are going to be voting on later today. As I've stated before, Defenders thinks that hunters are a very important partner when it comes to conservation and natural resource management. And when it comes to the conservation of grizzly bears, hunters have a very important role to play, especially black bear hunters, in learning the difference between both black and grizzly bears to reduce accidental mortality in two very small populations. populations of grizzly bears that we have in our state, both in the North Cascades and in the Selkirks. I wanted to share with you all some polling data that we completed recently. I handed it out, and I think that y'all should have it in front of you. But recently, we did a poll and got some results back. There were over 550 Washingtonians that we polled, 85% of which were from Ponderay, Stevens, and Spokane County. So we were really looking at the folks living around the Selkirk's ecosystems. And some of the questions we asked were about the bear identification test. 36% of our respondents knew about the identification test, so there's a lot of folks who don't know that the department already has one up there. And of the folks that did know about the test, less than a third of them had taken it. So it's really important, we think, for the annual test requirement so that folks are constantly taking it, getting that education, and being able to distinguish between black bears and grizzly bears, not just so that they're shooting the right bear, but also so that they can learn how to respond to different conflicts when those arise. The other thing that I found really interesting from the poll that we had is that over two-thirds of the respondents that we talked to said that they enjoyed knowing that there were grizzly bears in the area. So folks out in this neck of the woods and in Washington really love and appreciate living around grizzly bears. They just want to make sure that they can do it safely and respectfully. So this test is an important component of that, and we really encourage it to be approved. There's a lot more educational work that can be done with folks. In fact, next week I'm heading out to Newport, Washington to partner up with WDFW staff, Ponderay County, and the Kalispell Tribe on a bear spray and bear awareness training program that we're doing, providing bear spray to county and tribal staff and teaching them how to effectively use bear spray and recreate safely in bear country, hoping to further promote the use of bear spray out in the Selkirks region. And as Commissioner Keeney mentioned, the North Cascade Grizzly Bear Restoration Program is moving forward. And as bears are restored in this neck of the woods, we would also love to work with the department on more of these educational efforts in the North Cascades. If folks have questions about the survey, I'd be happy to chat with you about it more. We're working on developing the full rollout of all the results that we got from it, which were very encouraging, but wanted to share those initial results with you today.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Martha, good to see you.
Okay. Try to get through my multiple topics. So, first of all, the hunt dog training issue with the Snoqualmie Wildlife Area has taken yet another turn since the last commission meeting, and thanks to your report today, I understand a little bit more. WDFW is in the final stages of finishing the Snoqualmie Wildlife Area Management Plan, and a public meeting is scheduled for April 24th to take comments on this plan, the draft plan. While WDFW has worked to put the dog training concerns back into the local process with the Wildlife Area Planning and the Advisory Committee, of which I do sit on, the current hunt dog group appears to be circumventing this process as of still going on. The representative on the SWAC has not communicated anything to the committee, including an email sent to many hunting dog clubs requesting that they want 100 people at this public meeting to address their dog concerns. The dog group is also holding meetings with WDFW staff to discuss their concerns, and no one on the advisory committee other than their rep was notified or invited. So they are not staying in the process. Please be aware the WDFW records show that the dog training issue has been ongoing at the Snoqualmie Wildlife Area since at least 1997. I am deeply concerned that two citizen science projects were stopped early or compromised at this Cherry Valley and Stillwater as a result of the dog group wanting access to Cherry Valley earlier than normal. I support having hunt dog training on the wildlife areas. I know I train a dog there as well. That said, WDFW and the public cannot have a special interest group of any kind, whatever their interest is, manage or dictate management objectives at our wildlife areas. They are wildlife areas, and we need to look at all multiple user groups. That's where I'm going to end that comment. So, but what I really want to be here for is a heartfelt thank you to WDFW staff on the lead poisoning team for their hard work this past season with swans were present in our state. And this year has been particularly challenging. We did have one unexpected lead poisoning event in a new area, caught everybody blindsided, at the lake taps and surrounding areas east of Tacoma. And much to our surprise, this lead was not shot, it was fishing sinkers from the lake. At least 7 swans died from ingesting the sinkers. And I especially want to thank the WDFW staff who spent many hours over several weeks working with the lead team, including myself and Mel Walters of Puget Sound Energy, to resolve a conflict with a citizen who was extremely upset with the team's established and proven protocols for working with swans, both in capture and transport. This was one of the most difficult and challenging issues I have experienced in many years. Working with the agency was absolutely stellar. We came through with communication within the team and other agency staff was excellent. We listened and learned from each other and moved forward day by day. And believe me, it was hours every day working with staff across the state, including the state veterinarian. And so in the end, basically, the outcome is that we now have a stronger and more cohesive lead poisoning team. And for that, I am very grateful to everyone from the top in Olympia on down. And now that the swans have migrated, we can focus on finding out why the swans got access to lead sinkers this year, which the agency staff has requested my assistance along with someone else so that we can figure out what happened, because that's really where we want to focus. And to give you, Mr. Smith and the commission, an update, I just read my email that said, mortality this year overall for all of these counties, including Pierce County, 208 swans died this year that we picked up. And I know that that's a very low number because it's still not the final number, so we've probably got another 20 or 30. 71 were lead, 69 were power line collisions, 6 were other trauma, and 62 were undetermined, meaning that we found feather piles or we just don't know. Most of those were probably lead. And so, and there are many swans that I'm aware of, probably 7 or 8 down in the Pierce County area that we just were not able to capture or deal with because logistics was just, it was really the volunteers who were picking up all of the birds in Pierce County in the end. But the agency, as I said, absolutely stellar. And one final comment, I want to thank Kyle Spriggins in particular for his really superb work in putting together the waterfowl regulations this year and accommodating the multiple use and festivals and other things that the agency was not aware of in Skagit and Snohomish County with the extended hunt season proposal. And it was a real pleasure working with him and his working with the people to make these regulations work for everybody.
Thank you, Martha, and thank you for spending the time making all these things happen.
Thanks.
Okay, that brings us to a close of public comment.
No, you have 3 more.
Oh, no, I don't. No, I only. This is all I had.
Dennis De Silva.
Oh, where?
No, just call him up. Dennis.
Okay.
I don't know. And Jason Bolson.
It is Friday the 13th. I mean, the gremlins are out there.
Dennis, are you coming up?
No.
Okay. And Robert Sudar.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Jason Bolser. I represent the Washington State Archery Association. I'm just here to support the change in the antler list rules so that there's more antlerless archery opportunity in the Clockham and the Yakima units. I worked with Rick Weibel, who's the Traditional Bow Hunters of Washington, and we talked with Jerry Nelson and worked out a pretty good compromise, I think. So that's the reason why I'm here today.
Thank you. Oh, sorry to. Wasn't intentional.
I wasn't going to let you get away with it.
I didn't think you would. There's just so much paper, Alex.
Thank you, Commissioners, for the chance to comment. I want to talk about the letter I had sent to you this week that I put together about why we should get a chance to fish on our summer Chinook allocation this year. And the policy says we can use, we need an alternate gear other than gill nets that avoids sockeye and steelhead and sturgeon. The best gear that anybody's found is gill nets for avoiding the smaller steelhead and sockeye. I mean, it's just a ridiculous thing to, in my opinion, to put that in the policy that way, because it's strictly anti-gill net. There's no science that supports that kind of a distinction. We have an allocation under the commission policy. It's not very big. It's about 750 fish, but we want we want access to that using large mesh gill nets this year. We don't think there's any reason to not allow us to do that. We're the smallest harvest group now with this latest allocation. It's in the North of Falcon Agreement. The staff has identified the portion that would be ours if we could harvest it. At the North of Falcon meetings, I made it clear that I was going to be talking to the commission in one of my three-minute opportunities to pitch for this fishery to be reestablished this year. The marketplace wants it. I'm getting calls every week from people wondering if they're going to get anything off the Columbia this year, because it's, as you know, it's difficult to find Chinook that are harvestable. The Columbia River has them in all seasons this year. And so we've discussed it at North of Falcon. We have an allocation. The policy, the USB Oregon policy and the NIMS approval of that identifies 20,000 fish over Priest Rapids Dam as the target. They're getting that every year. They're averaging 50,000. There's no reason to not let us harvest these fish with our gill nets. Everything that we keep, we don't selectively pick just wild fish. As I put in the letter, that that was a decision to lengthen the sport fishery. That was not something that was brought by staff in those North of Falcon meetings 10 years ago. And we don't do that. We don't think there's no biological reason to do it. We have the largest harvest is in the ocean, actually. It's non-mark selective. The tribes have a large harvest that's non-mark selective. There's no reason to identify our little fishery as one that needs to be that way. All the fish we catch go to market. None of them are wasted. They're high-quality fish. They belong to the public. The public deserves some access to that. And even your own policy, I put a couple quotes in there from the Colville policy or agreement that says that you're going to provide balanced opportunity to the fleets. We don't have any opportunity the way this policy is written. You know, I just don't see any reason to not let us have that access this year. I didn't see any reason to not give it to us last year, but this year I had a little more time to address it. I'm going to give the same presentation in general to the Oregon Commission next week. And so I'd like you to initiate conversations with them to use adaptive management to allow us to have that harvest. We're willing to wait until late June or early July to fish. We'll let the recreational fishery have their prime opening right there at 16 when the June 16th when the season changes. We'll use large mesh nets. We want to fish in all zones. There's no reason to not have us fishing in all zones.
Thanks, Robert. Your points were well stated.
Okay.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't quite catch what you mentioned about the Oregon folks. So can you refresh our memory on what the Oregon policy says for this? And what did you say about something about approaching the Oregon Commission?
Well, we want it to be a joint decision. And the difference is that I think Oregon says that our share goes to conservation if we don't catch it. Washington is not as clear about that. But, I don't want Washington to make this decision without having some agreement from Oregon. I'm in favor of the joint management through the compact. It's been going on this is the 100th anniversary of that Columbia River Compact, where the states manage these runs jointly. And so I want to bring both states together through the directors, probably at this point in the year, to discuss implementation of that fishery. I don't think there's anything unreasonable, but I don't want Washington to be the only state that agrees. I would want both states to agree.
Mr. Keel.
Thank you, Robert, for coming. Just so I'm clear on your position, basically you're saying that the Washington policy provides for commercial harvest in the main stem,
right,
on spring, on summer Chinook, with alternative gear only. And your position is that given that there is no alternative gear that is ready for prime time that's going to be used, is like let's use gillnet gear, but still stay within, you know, all the other conservation constraints on the fishery, right? Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, basically. But I mean, the actual phrase says non-gillnet selective gear that avoids steelhead and sockeye, and all the gear they've tested all have a worse handle rate for those species than our gillnets do. That's how gillnets work, you know. And so, but that's basically part of what I'm saying too. You know, I mean, it doesn't make sense to me to not let us use the gear that's most selective to avoid the ESA listed fish. The Chinook are not ESA listed in the summer season.
Mr. Keeney.
Thank you. I hate to put staff on the spot, but I'm going to ask Ron, basically, is, you know, this is a compelling testimony, and is there a, we have adaptive management in all of these policies, but to actually get there, is there a path forward for you to take a look at what Mr. Sudar is suggesting and provide alternatives then back to the commission in a way that is possible to make an adaptive management change if it's warranted?
Thank you for the opportunity, Commissioner. Chair Smith, directors, Ron Warren with the Fish Program. I don't have as long a history with the Columbia River policy as some. My understanding is that industry and the department were to work on an alternative gear approach, and none have been selected for the summer fishery. That meets the commission policy. I don't know of any provision in the adaptive management section of that policy that would allow us to bypass that requirement to allow gillnet fishing or gillnet as a gear, but I would commit to review that. I'm going to assume that I will be seeing a letter in response to Mr. Sudar's letter to all of us, and review that and let folks know, commission and director's office know what I find.
That sounds good.
Thanks, Robert and Ron. I would say to my fellow commissioners that this issue of non-gillnet selective gear, as it's called often in the policy, is something that I think we're evaluating in the Fish Committee and will be as the full commission as part of the review of this this policy. I think the work that was done with the fall fishery and with gillnets and the monitoring has supported what Robert is saying, that there are a couple of concerns. One is the mortality of the fish, especially the listed fish, and the bycatch. The other is the handling and perhaps delayed mortality that results from that. And what the monitoring in the fall fishery demonstrated was there is less handling, as Robert is saying, with large mesh gillnet of some of the bycatch. And so there's kind of confusing terminology, as it turns out. I mean, what are we trying to achieve with selective? What the direction we're going is we don't want the mortality But we also don't want the handling that may lead to a bycatch that may lead to delayed mortality. So we are certainly, I think, as the Fish Committee and hopefully eventually as the entire commission, evaluating what Robert is bringing forward. And to add to it, as he points out, we've had this problem with all of the other alternatives that have been tested that the handling is very, very high. So we're not coming up with alternatives, and we're closing down opportunity for our commercial fisheries. I want to just bring this forward to the commission. It is something that really needs to look at because, as Ron points out, currently the policy kind of ties, because it's so specific and says non-gillnet and doesn't recognize gillnet, large mesh gillnet, as a selective gear, it really ties staff's hand in terms of the adaptive management portion of it. So just to put this forward, we're thinking a lot about this and evaluating it.
Sure. Last final comment on running late.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll just maybe ask this question and then reserve more discussion maybe under agenda item 31 for issues that arise during the meeting. If Mr. Warren's going to come back with some business, maybe that might be a time. But in the vein of trust but verify, I wondered if the question of whether or not the summer Chinook impacts were budgeted, so to speak, in the North of Falcon process, were reserved for this fishery, or were they used under a presumption that this fishery would be closed? Were they used for somewhere else? The other one is the ocean take of this same fish run in a selective or non-selective manner. What is the ocean take out there? And again, just in the honesty of verifying things for any possible decision, what kind of numbers were those? So if this is going to come up again at the very end, maybe I would not look for an answer to those right now.
And we'll let Commissioner Grable unwind this.
When the policy was initially agreed to between the two states after a panel of representatives from both states, Washington was adamant about having 100% passage of summer runs and no fishing allowed because 100% of these fish originate in the Upper Columbia River. That wasn't agreed to when those discussions concluded. That was left with a question mark on the last go-around. When we met with Oregon, we made a couple of concessions. One was a 75-25 split for the fall fish. Oregon wants 70-30. We did agree to an 80-20 split on summer runs to also kind of compensate for anticipated losses during the spring fishery and that sort of thing to compensate the gillnetters. Also, we're still not making escapement goals for our summer run fish and their home waters. Last year was the first year in at least five that we allowed a small bubble fishery to occur off the mouth of the Okanagan River. We determined there was about 900 fish available during that fishery. I don't know that that condition will occur this year or not. That's yet to be determined, but the Colville tribe is sometimes struggling to get their broodstock numbers for the hatchery, and the Okanagan River is the only one that we see any kind of escapement goals being met in the Upper Columbia.
So I think I should get a chance to respond to that. In that,
yeah, very short, though, Robert. We're running late.
The recreational fishery kills more wild fish through release mortalities than we would kill in our gillnet fishery. If you start looking at how many are killed in all of these handling, marked selective fisheries in the river, the recreational fishery kills more than we would, and ours at least go to market. And selective fishing or adaptive management was used in the spring seasons to, in the last 4 years, so we lost that fishery too, to allow a transition from tangle nets to regular large mesh gill nets in late May and June to avoid the handle of early returning steelhead and mostly shad. So that kind of a transition to a regular gill net gear from what's essentially in a selective gear has occurred in the past during the life of the policy. Okay. So
good.
Thank you.
And we'll be further discussed later in the day, too. So, all right. Thank you. Am I done now, Tammy?